Today's broadcast comes from the Corkscrew Wine Emporium, 203 North Vine, Urbana. The Corkscrew carries a full line of wines, beers, and spirits for everyone from the serious collector to the first-time buyer. Wine tastings are held every Friday from 6 to 8 p.m. and Saturday from 2 to 6. Information available at 337-7704 or on the web at thecorkscrew.com. Support for today's broadcast is provided by World Harvest International and Gourmet Foods at 6th and University in Champaign. For over 15 years, providing Champaign-Urbana with a wide array of name-brand foods from around the world. Your suggestions and requests are always welcome. World Harvest encourages you to join them in supporting public radio.
This is the Afternoon Magazine on WILL AM 580. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. Our guest today in this portion of the program is Masha Hamilton. Masha Hamilton is a former foreign correspondent for the Associated Press and the Los Angeles Times. She also reported for NBC Mutual Radio. Among the stories she covered were the collapse of the Soviet Union, conflict in the Middle East and Afghanistan in the aftermath of the U.S. war to oust the Taliban. Hamilton now has two novels to her credit, Staircase of a Thousand Steps and The Distance Between Us. Both are set in the Middle East. This afternoon we'll focus on the second, The Distance Between Us. The protagonist and narrator is a foreign correspondent, Caddy Blair. Let me share a couple of sentences with you from the book's jacket. Caddy Blair feels everything strongly, and so she works hard to keep her distance. It's the ethical thing for a journalist to do, especially in a war-torn region like the Middle East. And Caddy wants to believe that nothing is as important as covering the story. This afternoon, I suspect our discussion will cover a number of subjects. I suspect we'll talk about the work journalists do and the price paid for getting the story. We may also talk about writing fiction and nonfiction. Of course, we'll talk about the novel, The Distance Between Us. Listeners, if you have questions or comments, let us hear from you. Join us with a telephone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, call toll-free 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Masha Hamilton currently lives in New York City with her husband and three children. She teaches at the Gotham Writers Workshop. Her latest novel, The Distance Between Us, is published by Unbridled Books. 333-9455, that's the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free 800-222-9455. Masha Hamilton, thank you so much for joining us. Masha, excuse me, forgive me.
Celeste, thank you for having me.
Oh, my pleasure. You dedicate the book to a news photographer and friend, a South African by the name of Kevin Carter. Not long after winning the Pulitzer Prize, he took his life. He killed himself. What happened to Kevin Carter?
Kevin Carter was a member of the Bang Bang Club. It was a group of four photojournalists based in South Africa who were covering the conflict and the violence during that very bloody period as apartheid was finally being brought to an end. They got amazing pictures, Celeste, from very close. They got, for example, a group of black men from one tribe beating and burning to death another man. And they got a picture of white supremacists being executed. They were very close to these pictures. And Kevin was one of these four photographers. He wrote about that particular incident, for example. Your mind is thinking, oh, my God, but you know you have to get the picture. He decided to take a break by going to the Sudan, and there he covered victims of starvation. He went to a feeding center where the victims were coming in, where 20 were dying every day from starvation conditions, even once they reached the feeding center. He found a young girl with her head to the ground, her knees up, skin and bones, and a vulture stood behind her. He stopped and took pictures of this girl for about 20 minutes. He was waiting for the vulture to spread its wings, but it never did. He then sunk under a tree, and a friend came up to him, another member of the Bang Bang Club, actually, and he described the pictures he'd gotten. The friend went to try to capture the same images and could find neither the girl nor the vulture. Kevin's photograph of this girl was published in a number of places, including the New York Times, and from the New York Times, it went on to win the Pulitzer, which was, of course, an amazing honor. And he came here to New York City and was praised and feted. Yeah, this was in the 1980s for this picture. But he was also asked, what happened to that little girl? Did you scoop her up and take her to the feeding center? Did you at least shoo away the vulture? And he had to answer, no. I was concentrated on taking the picture, on doing my job. And I'm sure that this was a difficult moment for him. It certainly is a question many journalists face, that line between being the observer and concentrated on doing your job and being forced to be a participant. And again, I don't want to oversimplify Kevin Carter's story by any means, but he did go back to South Africa, and 2 months after getting the Pulitzer, as you've said, he parked his red pickup truck in a field where he had played as a child, and he hooked up the exhaust pipe and he killed himself. And he cited as one of the reasons the violence and the horrors that he had covered and how they continued to haunt him. So I think one reason I dedicated to him and others like him is that I think journalists often pay a price for the coverage that they bring us out of the war of Iraq or the war of Afghanistan or the stories that Kevin covered.
Yeah. That question, what happened to the girl, is a question anyone who sees the picture wants to know. And it leads then to thinking about the responsibility or responsibilities of journalists in such situations. You know, at once, how do you keep your humanity and how do you do your job?
Absolutely. Celeste, I think it's a crucial question, and I think it's one of the things that initially motivated me to try to write this story, The Distance Between Us, because I think that as journalists, it's important for us to not get too emotionally involved. We can't stop what we're doing and go, oh my God, and crumble and collapse and have all that reaction, or we won't really be able to cover the story. What we are is the pipe, so that the story can travel out to viewers or readers elsewhere so they can understand what's going on. To do that, we need to push our own emotions back into a corner. But in pushing our own emotions back, sometimes we become a bit less human. So it's a very thin line or a difficult balance, I would say, to maintain.
Yeah. I suspect there are a number of emotions at work here. We've got the altruistic desire to tell a story that should be told. We've got the curiosity on the part of the individual journalist. There's also got to be fear involved often. And maybe there's a little ambition thrown into the mix as well. I'm asking you to generalize here, but what is it that motivates the journalist?
That's a great question, and I think you've touched on a number of things. And to that I might add the adrenaline rush of being in a story. You are there, but not just as an observer. In a way, you're a participant because you are covering it. You know, you are not watching it at home the way you would on the TV set or reading it in the newspaper. You are right there. I have heard war photographers describe this as being sort of on the stage in the theater as opposed to in the audience. And I think that makes you, it draws you into the story, and it makes your own life feel larger somehow, if that makes sense. And I think also, yes, you've mentioned the fear aspect. When journalists survive something that might be considered dangerous, there's a subtle feeling of invincibility. Of course, intellectually, they know they're not invincible, but there's, I believe, an emotional response that often happens that feels, you know, I'm not touchable here, so I'm going to be okay. And so maybe some of that plays into it as well. Definitely, there's also an interest, many, many journalists will tell you, in bringing the story, a feeling of, okay, I'm doing something that really is useful because I'm going to let the viewers see what this situation is, let them understand. But that's the reason that is most often cited by journalists, and to stop there would be missing a bunch of other things too, I think.
Yeah. Does a journalist covering the horrors of the world deal with all these emotions, or does the job, getting the story, become a way to put a shell around yourself, become a way to not deal with the situation?
Great question, and I think that while you're covering stories, you can't deal with it. Again, I think it would make you incapable. You know, you have to continue covering the story. In my experience, journalists covering conflict who saw or experienced awful things didn't come back in the evening and sit around and talk about it. Sometimes they drank, sometimes they talked about other things, but they didn't come back and dwell on that. And in my own case, and again, I didn't cover war. I didn't bounce from war to war, but I did experience conflict and did have to push back my own emotions. And I didn't really come to face-to-face with that until I stopped being a daily journalist and wrote the first novel, and in doing that got in touch with my own emotions and realized how I had exactly that, put a shell around them.
Hmm. Why did you leave journalism to write fiction?
I thought that I could get a little deeper or a little closer to a kind of truth through fiction. I loved being a journalist and still do journalism. You know, I was just in the spring in Afghanistan, and I'm still very interested in the world events. But I started to feel that although we are accurate as journalists, maybe now and then we miss a chance to get to the truth, if that distinction makes any sense.
Mm-hmm.
And I wanted through fiction to go somewhere else. And that's kind of what drew me in. And also, actually, I was working in Moscow at the time, and I began to dream anecdotes, fictional anecdotes. And I would wake up in the morning, and they would be as real to me as you are here talking to me. But then I was so busy that by noon I had forgotten them. And I realized that I had to probably stop and write them, or I had to let go of that. And I wasn't ready to let go, so I stopped and wrote them.
Yeah. In the course of writing this book, you went back to the Middle East and you talked with friends and colleagues. Researching and writing this book, The Distance Between Us, did you discover something that was new to you about conflict and reporting on conflict?
I think that I discovered things that maybe I kind of always knew, but I wasn't in touch with, if that makes sense.
Mm.
The aspect of fear, the fact that in these scenes of violence there can be some poetry, and that draws you in. The adrenaline rush that keeps you getting closer and closer and closer, the lust of the eye is the phrase from the Bible, by which I mean you want to see more and more and more. I've watched this with myself and with friends, but focusing in on that and not focusing in so much on anything else but just on that. Going back at the start of the Second Intifada, a very violent period, and going again to those conflicts where the tear gas was flowing and the bullets were flying, and observing myself and my journalists instead of the story so much, allowed me to really zero in on that, because that's what I wanted to write about.
Hmm. Masha Hamilton is our guest this afternoon here on The Afternoon Magazine. She's a former foreign correspondent. She now has two novels to her credit, Staircase of a Thousand Steps, and her latest is The Distance Between Us. My name is Celeste Quinn, and listeners, I invite you to join us this afternoon. Your questions and comments are welcome. 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. We have a listener waiting to talk with us on line one in Mahomet. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. I was wondering, I just finished a book, Seymour Hersh's book, Chain of Command. I don't know if you're familiar with it by any chance.
I haven't read it, no.
In any event, to a great extent, it's an indictment of the administration and their policies in Afghanistan and Iraq. But I was wondering, how do you assess the United States' success in Afghanistan? I know that they now say that 60% of the GDP is derived from drug money, or however they work that exactly, for instance, at an indictment. And then the fact that the United States, is just their policies there. What do you think? Do you call it a success?
I spent a couple weeks there. I focused in on the conditions for women. I was interested in seeing how they had changed. Mm-hmm. I got to speak to women in prison in Kabul and Kandahar, including a 12-year-old who was jailed for refusing to marry the man her father's age that her father had chosen. But I also got a chance to speak to some opium farmers, poppy farmers, and actually to taste a little bit of that juice. It's horrible. I can't imagine how they ever... And to sit in their homes and hear a little bit about their conditions. I think that things have definitely improved with the Taliban not directly in power. The Taliban is still, of course, there in many ways, but they're not directly in power. One woman told me about the the morning with the Taliban in power when she came out and found human limbs hanging from the light fixtures and the street signs as an unspoken warning. Certainly, things have improved since then. But as another woman told me, it's like going from negative 100 to negative 98. There's a long way to go there. In terms of our administration and our successes or failures there, our attention has been pulled away from there, perhaps a bit too soon, but it has to be because, of course, we're in Iraq now. I would rather see us in Afghanistan doing more to make inroads, to improve life for the people there, to make strong ties, because I think it's still a very vulnerable area in terms of conservative or, if you want to say, terroristic elements taking over. It's still very vulnerable. But, as I say, our attention has been directed elsewhere.
Thank you.
I hope that helps answer the question.
Thanks for the call. 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. To follow up on what you were just saying there, and then going back to when you talked about the lust of the eye a moment or two ago, the epigraph that you used to open the distance between us talks about, it is from J. Glenn Gray, The Warriors. Anyone who has watched people crowding around the scene of an accident on the highway realizes that the lust of the eye is real. Anyone who has watched the faces of people at a fire knows it is real. Seeing something absorbs us utterly. It is as though the human being becomes one great eye. The eye is lustful because it requires the novel, the unusual, the spectacular. It cannot satiate itself on the familiar, the routine, the everyday. How does our appetite for the novel, the unusual, the spectacular affect the news coverage that we get?
That's a great question, and I think it's very complex. I think part of it is that sometimes we don't have time to see the story in its very human element. A way to explain it might be this. We take a look at what happens on a certain day in Baghdad. Let's say that four Iraqis are killed. But that's not new, right? That's, in fact, very old right now, unfortunately. That's not an uncommon occurrence. If we could stop and make them human, if we could describe their families, their goals, their lives, and make them real in some way, that would work. But we don't always have time. Oftentimes, our producers or our news editors are going to say, that's not a big enough story. We need to move on. We need, you know, what's really new here? I'm sure you know exactly what I'm talking about, Celeste. And that experience, that need to give the viewers or the readers the newest, the latest, the freshest, the new angle, can sometimes cause us to overlook just the basic misery or difficulties that people are facing in a certain situation like that.
Yeah. The protagonist, the narrator of The Distance Between Us, Cady Blair, she has this kind of regret, and it comes home to her at the end of the story when she's thinking back at a time where she wishes she had gone to a morning house.
Exactly. There is that scene where she is remembering seeing a little girl dead. And what really moved her, though, was the grandmother's reaction. And she wished she would have spent more time going into that story, but there was no time. Cady finds herself distant from the story in a certain sense in order to cover it. And she finds that has also made her distant in a way from love, which is another aspect of this on a personal level for journalists. Sometimes keeping that emotional distance from the story constrain other relationships. And that's something that Cady discovers and also feels some regret for, because her sometimes lover, Marcus, the photographer, in the beginning is killed, and she has regrets in connection with that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Without saying too much, maybe you'd give us a further sense of the arc of the story.
It begins when Marcus is killed. Cady and Marcus and two other colleagues are on their way to interview in South Lebanon, a sort of crime king, Lebanese crime king. And On the way, they are ambushed, and Marcus is killed. That's the start of the story, and that's what propels Caddy into the rest of the story. It forces her to re-examine much in her life, of course, covering conflict, what the violence has meant to her, what love means to her, what it means to love, and also, maybe just as importantly, revenge. She begins to feel a little bit differently about revenge. She wonders if she should do something to revenge Marcus's life. She thinks maybe that's the moral choice, after all, and doing nothing is not the moral choice. And she looks at the people who she has been interviewing a little bit differently, because she's not, it's not so much me and them, it's a little bit more all of us for her, now that this has pulled her somehow into the conflict, if that makes sense.
Yeah. Talk with us about the theme of distance and how the title works in this novel, The Distance Between Us.
The title really refers to the distance that Caddy keeps between her own emotions and the story, the distance that she has between her and Marcus, and then another man who comes into the story, Goransky, sort of victim himself of terrorism as a child, who encourages her to revenge. That distance, the place that it occupies in her life, and how she begins to examine that after Marcus's death.
Mm-hmm. The idea of revenge is a very interesting one, and very thoughtful the way you explore it here in the book. And one of the things that was that came to my attention when I opened the book was a little flyer fell out, of course, when I opened up the book, and it came with the book from you, and it says, "My hope is that the distance between us will spark a dialogue about how Americans should respond to the current climate of hostility in the world, how exposure to violence on a regular basis changes us both as individuals and as a culture." Because revenge can warp into, you can think of it as self-defense, as self-preservation, as retribution. Mm-hmm. I don't know what you want to, that's sort of amorphous. I haven't really asked a question, but maybe you'd care to explore those things with us here.
I'll jump in there and try. Caddy, in this story, she has no children, and she's pushed kind of to the end in this story. She's pushed to the edges of who she is as a person. Her soul becomes in danger. She is really pretty determined at certain points to carry out revenge, and begins to plan how she could do it. She's going to go back to Lebanon. She's going to bring with her $1,000. She's going to hire somebody. She's going to, you know, she begins to really think of a plan. She's going to get Marcus's killers, because she can't do nothing. That would be wrong, to do nothing. And in the course of the story, she sees someone else carrying out a form of revenge. And this happens near the end, and through that she recognizes that may not be the answer for her. I think it's an interesting question. Does revenge end up satisfying us? Does it meet those needs that make us seek it in the first place? Is it the right answer? I think I think it's a question our country has had to consider and is still in process, I think, of considering. So, and Caddy kind of considers it on an individual basis for herself.
Hmm. How do you think exposure to violence changes us as a culture?
Well, it's a very difficult question when we see it on a regular basis. And I don't know that I see it in black and white. I think I have some more grays about it. Do we become inured to it, or do we go, oh my gosh, this isn't good, we need to stop and change something? You know, the Bush administration has said that we can't see coffins coming back from war, and there is, of course, some decisions by various networks and other reporters not to show us certain things that are so horrible. And I just, you know, you wonder, is that a good choice? Or is it bad? Should we know everything that is being done in our names in any part of the world? I think it's a topic for discussion, and I know that there would be lots to talk about on both sides of that issue, and I myself am somewhat conflicted about it, except that I guess I feel that we should see what's being done in our names. Abu Ghraib is an example of something that was very painful for our country and also very bad for us in terms of our reputation and our standing in certainly the Arab world, if not the world in general. Should that have all been broadcast? Should it have been published and publicized everywhere? Or should it not have been? You know, it's an interesting question.
Hmm. What do you think of the quality of the coverage of conflict we have at the moment?
I think that journalists are doing the very best they can. I think that American journalists, from what I have been told by my friends, it's difficult right now in Iraq. You know, it's dangerous. And most of them feel safer embedded, reporting from an embedded position. Doing that, though, limits what you can see, of course. So we can't rely just on them. It's not their fault, but they can't operate independently. Not very many of them speak Arabic and can just travel freely around Iraq and get that side of the story. So we can't always. We have to go to many sources, I think, for our information. But I think the journalists are doing a great job.
Yeah. Is self-censorship a problem for reporters?
You know, that's really an interesting question, and I'm not there, so I don't know, although I know Kevin Seitz, you know, he broadcast his picture of an American soldier shooting, you know what I'm talking about, a wounded Iraqi, and I know he had some questions and doubts about doing that, and he waited a couple of days, as I understand, and then he did it. When I was based in Israel, there was a censor who would take stuff, pieces out of our copy, on a regular basis. I was there nearly 5 years, and of course after only a few months it was pretty predictable what kind of things the censor would remove. And we used to talk about this. We used to debate this. We used to say, okay, so what do? We save ourselves a little bit of time and pull this out already and, you know, then send it to the censor, or do we leave it in there knowing that the censor is going to take his little red pen and mark through it? And I used to argue along with some others, no, you put it all in. You make the censor take it out. Don't start self-censoring because then you don't know where you're going to draw that line. Put it in there and then just put your note on it saying the censor has removed some material from this story. So, but it is an interesting question and, again, something that can kind of creep up on you if you don't watch, I think.
Yeah. Do you think that reporters struggle with the issue of the consequences of the story they tell?
I'm sure they do. I know they do. They've talked about it. Many of them have many times. And many of them wonder, you know, what they're accomplishing. And, you know, the first time I saw a body was actually in the States when I was covering. I was based in Indiana, and I was called late at night. I'd been covering election stuff, and I was called to cover this event that was going on right then. A man was shooting from his house, and he killed a police officer and a father-in-law and somebody else. It was going on right at that moment, and it was like 11 o'clock at night, and I took off, and I went to the police barricade, and I was blocked from entering. And the officer that was blocking us looked at me. I was the only woman there, and he said, "Let me see your ID, little lady," or something like that, you know, and it kind of irritated me. So I showed him my ID, and then I snuck around the barricade, left my fellow journalists, went over a backyard and on in and got all the way up close to this event that was still going on. The man was still in the house firing shots, and the neighbors were kind of standing back, and there in the middle of the street was the police officer who had been killed. Nobody was getting him yet. And I began to talk a little bit to the guy next to me, another police officer. It turns out he was the brother of the police officer lying on the road out there. I got a lot of details and quotes. I went into somebody's house, called these in to the AP, went back out, covered some more. This story, I was way ahead, of course, all my colleagues who were back behind the barricade. And the next day I came in and I got all these kudos. Wonderful job. You did this great little feature on the election, and then you did this wonderful breaking news story, and you were way ahead of everybody. And I felt like a vulture. You know, I felt, what did I really accomplish in covering that? It was, you know, it was a horrible thing. And I realized I had to deal with that feeling or change professions. I think that's just a small example from one person of what I think journalists go through all the time. Hmm.
Let's talk with another listener. Caller in Champaign County, line one. Hi.
Good afternoon. I was going to call in about the power of the image, but since a guest has made this kind of blanket statement about how good, and they're doing as good as they can, for people who use the Internet and can compare other coverage from other foreign correspondents from around the world, and then compare it to what's in the American press, it's a pretty damning praise to say that's the best that the U.S. can do. The image that I was thinking of was the toppling of the statue. Other places in the world, the cameras drew back and showed how few people were really there. But the CNN cameras and the footage that was shown here in the U.S. was all this tight footage that made it look like there was a huge self-motivated throng doing that. And that's an old story, but there's still a lot of people that don't realize that that was cropped, and that the cropping did reinterpret the reality in a large way and according to what the U.S. Government was wanting to have portrayed.
Great comment. And let me just tell you another example of cropping after 9/11 in East Jerusalem on Saladin Street, where Arabs were showing cheering, and it looked like an enormous crowd, and it was, I've been told, like 12 people or something. You're totally right. And you're also right in that American journalists' coverage is sometimes limited, and I would say not necessarily in this kind of way, like they're trying to show something, but they don't have as access to as much information, or they don't have access to all of it, or they're embedded and they're limited. And in this case, I have to say, I mean, in a way, maybe I agree with you. I think it's our responsibility as viewers and as readers and as Americans to seek out information from other sources. The unfortunate thing is that most of our journalists there do not speak Arabic, do not have access to the other side, if you will. And I think we need to have that access. Does that make sense? What do you
think? Yeah, it does. Somebody who does have access in Iraq is a very courageous young journalist named Christian Parenti. And from him I learned that there was a widespread usage of the cards that you use to get your food allotment. I'm drawing a blank on what that's called. But and apparently, particularly in Baghdad and some of the Sunni neighborhoods, the word was out that if you didn't get, as well as putting ink on your finger, you had to get your ration card stamped. And if you weren't going to get your ration card stamped, they would be uncooperative about giving your food allotment. Mm-hmm. And that this is one of the things that is, I've never heard it reported on anywhere else. This man has really good contacts, and one can talk about the images of the election and see, and if you know how to look, you can see the green color of Shiism, and you know that the shot is in Basra, it's not, or in Sadr City, where the Shia are popular. You can tell the Kurds from the others if you know some of the headdress, but if you just look at the pictures of people dancing and et cetera, you're misled there too, I think. But this thing about the ration cards needing to be stamped, I think, is just one of those things that you'd have to have very good context for somebody to tell you about. So I'm sure that's probably being reported on in the Arab world, but as I say, I've only heard it in one place. Robert Byrd is giving his testimony on Gonzalez right now. I think I'm going to go back to that and thank you.
Thank you.
He's media, what is it, multiple
that's right, good for him.
Multitasking media there this afternoon. You want to make any further comments, Masha?
No, I was just going to say I'll look definitely for this website. I think that the points raised by the listener are great and are important, and I love this kind of dialogue. I think it's so important to us as a country. I think that again, these are journalists, American journalists there. I remember reading something sent in an email message form from a reporter from the Wall Street Journal who was in Baghdad at one point. Now this is like 2 months ago, and saying, you know, he could barely leave his room because it was just so, it had become so dangerous. And so of course, what he can do, the information we'll get from him will necessarily be limited, you know. And in that case, as I say, I just feel we have to go a little deeper.
Yeah. I remember I was home on the day that Donald Rumsfeld was in Iraq and was challenged by a soldier.
Mm-hmm.
And I heard a report on the BBC that morning, and then later in the day I turned on the television. And talk about burying the lead. Mm-hmm. The news story that I saw on television failed to mention that Rumsfeld had been challenged and that for a moment he was left speechless.
And I don't know why. You wonder why. And I think I, too, have had questions. I mean, I know that I, too, have had questions about, you know, the way that some of these stories have been covered. And I think it's good for us to talk about those questions. I think that after 9/11, there may have been something that happened to our mentality as a country. There may have been a conservatism that came among journalists. When we look back on this years later, we may say this was not a great period in some ways because the journalists felt so conservative and so like rally around the fire. Not all journalists. I want to be careful in how I put this, but in some cases, perhaps there's a rallying around the fire that we as viewers can say, hey, wait a minute, maybe when we say coalition, we should say who exactly we mean. Maybe we should pull out from that shot. Maybe we should mention the fact that, you know, these vehicles are not being properly reinforced, and that's got to be the lead. And people saying that can help keep us all, you know, honest in some way. But I do not believe there's an intentional effort or desire to mislead her in any way. It's a complicated story that a lot of people are covering while feeling personally endangered, and that's a lot to be doing.
Hmm. In the novel The Distance Between Us, Caddy speaks Arabic, but she sees herself falling short on local colloquialisms. Mm-hmm. It's a tough thing. How does a journalist, a good journalist, prepare?
You know, this is a really interesting question, and I think that the push and pull is between being based in a story or being parachuted in. And the ideal situation, of course, is to be based somewhere and be there already when something happens, because then you have sources and contacts, and you know at least some of the language, and if you don't know that much, you have translators, and you have some sense of the story that goes beyond this moment and this event. But in both Afghanistan and Iraq, we had to parachute in reporters, and that is challenging for the reporter, to say the least. I mean, the joke among journalists, of course, is getting the quote from the taxi driver on the way in from the airport so that you can get it out there. You know, it's very hard to be parachuted in, I think, to stories.
Yeah. Do you think the way journalists who work abroad are trained, assigned, and monitored needs some rethinking?
I think that there's become an issue between a financial issue. Can we afford to keep somebody based in these locations? Maybe that's the issue. I think journalists, American journalists that I know, are professional, committed to being as accurate as possible, committed to being informed. But they can only do what they're allowed to do. And if they're based somewhere, as I say, they have a better chance, I think, of giving us depth and maybe even a bit of wisdom on stories.
Hmm. How did you prepare for going to the Middle East?
Well, actually, I was studying French when I got sent to the Middle East. So I arrived on the ground with a little bit of preparation in terms of studying history and that kind of thing. While I was there, though, the 5 years that I was based there, I was lucky to be based there for so long, so I had time to read not only the Bible, but the Quran and the Torah, and to study history books from a variety of angles. You know, history is not absolute, and when you look at it from various points, it comes out a little bit differently. And my boss there always told me, you know, get to know the story very deeply and then write it as though you've just arrived. Write it fresh. So I guess that's what I was trying to do.
Yeah, pretty tall order.
Yeah.
5 years in Jerusalem, both of your novels are set in the Middle East. What are your feelings about the place and the people?
Obviously, I have a deep affection for the area. I feel that it's rich in many ways. I feel that it's spiritually rich and historically rich, and I feel that we often see it under a veil of politics and who's right and who's wrong, and that's not how I feel about it. I feel maybe everybody's right and everybody's wrong, or something, you know, a little bit right and a little bit wrong, maybe all the way around. But I left there with a strong emotional attachment to the people and to the land. Mm.
The Distance Between Us is a work of fiction, but your experience had to have helped you shape the main character, Caddy Blair, and the other characters in the book. A couple of questions here. The first one would be, when you began writing fiction, was it difficult to give yourself permission to get into the story?
To lie, huh?
To make it up.
To make it up. You know, this wasn't my first novel, and I don't right. think it could have been my first novel. I don't think I was ready to write this the first time around. I really felt that if I told my own story, in some ways, it would be limiting. I did throw out 100 pages of this novel when I was writing it, when it was a manuscript form, 100 fairly polished pages, because it was starting to be too much about me, and I wanted it to really be about Caddy, this particular character, with her particular background and her particular concerns. So, although, of course, I brought what I know and what I know from my own experiences, what I know from the experiences of my colleagues and friends to the story, I also really tried to listen to the character, Caddy, and to understand her in this situation. Mm.
Second question here. Would you talk about the process of taking something you know and applying your imagination to create fiction?
For me, it really has to do with character, with character, 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 listening to the character. Sometimes I have the sense that I'm sitting next to the character on an airplane or trapped on a long flight, and she or he is slowly telling me their story. I wanted this novel to end in a different way. I felt it would work better if it ended differently, if Caddy did something different. I felt the story would work better. But I couldn't make her do it. Every time I tried, it just came out stilted. It didn't work. So finally, I was trying to write that ending, and I left my kids at the library. I said, I'm going to go get my hair trimmed, like I usually did. Instead, I let them just cut it all off. Maybe it's a woman thing. And I tried to let go of control in that way and to say, okay, I'm not going to control Caddy. I'm going to let her live. Let her do what she wants. Maybe this sounds kind of crazy, but that's the way I approach the fiction. That's the feeling I have mm-hmm. about it.
Many, many writers that I've talked to, they say the same thing. You've got to let the characters find their way.
We're all crazy.
You're not alone. What led you to pursue a career in journalism? And then maybe we touched on this a little bit earlier, but in terms of what led you then to take the plunge to write fiction?
You know, I think I always wanted to write fiction, but I wasn't quite ready. I needed to learn more about the world or whatever. I wanted to go live overseas. I mean, when I was graduating from college, I wanted to go live somewhere, not as a tourist or a passing visitor. I wanted to settle in and become local, if you will. And I wanted to be able to ask people nosy questions, and I wanted to write. And that seemed like journalism to me. So that's what drew me in. But I always did want to write fiction. And I always thought if I were brave enough, at some point I would come to it. So that's what happened.
Yeah. Do you think that fiction for you has provided a refuge?
I think it's allowed me to go deeper than I was able to through journalism. I love journalism. I love being in the world outside. I love touching it, knowing it, inhaling it, seeing it, feeling it. But it takes you out of yourself in some way, you know? And so the fiction allows me to go back in. And I think this novel in particular, Caddy's story, maybe it was a refuge in a way. Maybe it allowed me to understand something that happened to me in a way, and not only me, in a way that I would not have if I hadn't written Caddy's story. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm. There we have to leave it. We're out of time. I want to thank you very much for joining me this afternoon.
I want to thank you for having me. It's been great.
Masha Hamilton has been our guest in this portion of the Afternoon Magazine. She's the author of two novels. She's a former foreign correspondent. Her two novels, Staircase of a Thousand Steps, that was her first. And the one we've been focusing on this afternoon is The Distance Between Us. Both are set in the Middle East. The Distance Between Us, published by Unbridled Books. 9 minutes before 2 o'clock Central Time, settlement prices should be in from the Chicago Board of Trade. Here's Todd Gleason.
Thanks much, Celeste. From the Board of Trade this afternoon, futures in the bean pit finished down about a penny and three quarters for the day. The corn was off roughly the same amount. The March wheat down a half for the day. We'll start there as we usually do on every afternoon. Trade is available. 291.5 was the high price for the day in the wheat pit, that the March contract, at 291.5. And the low price at 287.75, the settlement to 288.25, down a half cent. The May futures ranged from $3.50 to $2.96 for the trade day, and settled at 296.75 in the soft red winter wheat May futures, down a half cent. July contract at 307, high low at 303. Settlement price there, 303.25, and they were off a half for the day. And the September futures, 310.25, the high, low at 308.5. A settlement price there at 308.75. They were down 4.25 for the day. December futures off 3.25, 321, the high, the low at 316.75. Settled at $3.17 a bushel. March corn for the day, $1.96.25, the high, the low at $1.95, settled 1.95.25. They were off 1.75. May futures at 202.75, or rather 202.75 low, the high at 204. Settlement price 203.25. They were off a penny and a half. July contract in the corn pit, 211.25, the high, the low at 210, settled $2.10.5. Down a penny and a half in the September futures. 219, the high, the low at 217.75. Settled 218, down 1.5 for the day. December contract, 228.5, the high, the low at 227.5. Settlement price, 227.75, down a penny and a half in the March futures. 235.75 high, low at 234.75. Settlement price at 235. They were a penny and a quarter lower. March oats for the day, 168.75, the high, the low at 164. Settled at 165.75, down 2.25, and the May contract 160.75 high, low at 157. Settlement price at 158.25, and they were down 2.5 cents for the day. March soybeans now, 509 the high, the low at 505. Settlement price at $5.51, down a penny and 3/4. That's 505.25 for the March contract, a penny and 3/4 lower in the bean pit. The May futures of 509.5 high, low at 505.5. Settlement price 506.25. They were off 3/4. July futures of 515.5 high, low at 511.5. Settlement price at 512.25. They were down 3/4. August contract now 518 the high, the low at 515. Settled at $5.15. Down on that low for the August beans, down 2 cents on the day. September futures 520.5 the high, low at 518.25. Settled 518.25, down 3/4 for the day. And the November contract in the bean pit, a 529 high, the low at 525.25, settlement price at 526.25, and they finished down 0.75 cents. Just a reminder, coming up during the closing market report today, we will not talk with Paul Cooley of ADM Investor Services out of Oakland, Illinois. He's out in Casey along with Dave Dickey and a group of other analysts from the WILL stable of crop analysts and market brokers, taking a look at what's happening at the marketplace at Richards Farm Restaurant. There. We wish them the best of the luck today. Instead of having Paul on, we'll have Mike Zuzolo, who's our regular Friday analyst. Mike will join us today to take a look at what happened in the futures market. The March corn, or rather March bean meal now, 152.80 the high, low at 151.80. Their settlement price at 152.20. That was down 50 for the day. And the May bean meal, 152.70 the high, the low at 152.10. Settlement price at 152.60. And it finished the day 20 higher. Bean oil for the day, 18.92 the high, the low at 18.92 was the low, the high at 19.15. The settlement price, 18.94, finished a dime lower. And the May bean oil, 19.30 the high, the low at 19.11, a settlement price at 19.13, and it finished off 8 cents for the day. Now here's Celeste Quinn with the numbers from the Mercantile Exchange. Celeste?
Thank you, Todd. A lower day today on the Mercantile Exchange. March feeder cattle, 101.30 the high, 99.80 the low. The settlement, 99.95, that down 97.5. April, $100.70 the high, 99.70 the low. The settlement, 99.77.5, that down 97.5. May, 99.95 the high, 99.10 the low. The settlement, 99.17.5, that down 85. February live cattle, 91.07.5 the high, 90.45 the low, 90.70 the settlement, that down 7.5. April live cattle, 88.75 the high, 88.17.5 the low, the settlement, 88.25, that down 25. February lean hog, 73.10 the high, the low and the settlement, 71.62.5, that down the limit, down $2. April, 74.72.5 the high, the low and the settlement today, 73.12.5, that down $2. May lean hog, 75.70 the high, the low, 74 even, finishing today at 74.10, down 187.5. June lean hogs, 77.55 the high, 75.97.5 the low. The settlement, 76.07.5, that down 190. February pork bellies, 93.15 the high, the low, 90.80. The settlement, 90.92.5, that down 287.5. The Dow is up 41 points at 10,593. The NASDAQ up 2 at 2070. The S&P 500 up 3 points at 1192.
Agricultural information is made possible with support from ADM, working with the American farmer, creating products from his crops, creating markets for his crops. ADM, resourceful by nature.
It's time once again to Ask Dr. Science. So let's ask Dr. Science.
That's me.
Remember, he knows more than you do.
That's right.
Dear Dr. Science writes the Chemistry in Everyday Life class at SUNY in Purchase, New York. Will the sky still be blue after global warming?
Bluer than blue. In fact, the sky will be so blue it'll be brown, which is what happens when blue freaks out and goes completely over the edge. You might remember from your kindergarten watercoloring experiments that all colors ultimately turn into a sort of purple-brown when allowed to blend together unsupervised. This is what rock star Prince had in mind with his hit Purple Rain, a hymn about the future we can expect after global warming. Its original title was more scientifically accurate, Brown Rain, but cooler minds prevailed at the record company.
Thank you, Dr. Science. Send your science questions to Ask Dr. Science. Remember, he's not a real doctor.
I have a master's degree
in science.
Produced by Duck's Breath and distributed by PRI. To purchase the Duck's Breath 30th Anniversary Show on DVD featuring Dr. Science, Randy of the Redwoods, Ian Scholes, and other classic characters, visit drscience.com.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from Lincoln Square Village in Urbana, with more than a dozen shops, businesses, and restaurants.